Hello, listeners. Greg here. When Toby and I first started recording our thoughts on the New Century Multiverse, the biggest concern on everyone's minds was the COVID-19 pandemic. People around the world were trying to keep themselves safe, occupied, entertained, and stable. And when I first started editing this episode, the same was still more or less true, especially in the U.S. But normalcy and stability have taken a further hit, thanks to a fresh round of police violence with the murder of George Floyd and others in the black community. Protests are now taking place in major cities around the U.S., which are being escalated into riots by bad actors. New information is coming in by the day, by the hour, and it's been difficult to do this editing work. I'd rather be sleeping, disengaging with distracting media, or even scrolling on Twitter and trying to inform myself, to spread the right kind of information to others, and find causes to give whatever small monies I have. I'm still going to try and put this podcast out on schedule, and I may or may not succeed. Part of me feels like it may be counterproductive, but if there are people out there that need to take a mental health break and pay attention to something that isn't current events, then maybe this podcast is still worthwhile. I don't think that my tiny audience needs to hear this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Black lives matter. Justice for George Floyd. And everyone continue to keep yourselves safe and sane. With that, come with myself and Toby on a trip to another world through the wind door. Welcome back to another episode of Through the Wind Door with Toby and Greg talking about Let Them Go. I hope that in spite of the darkness that the story has taken us to so far, that you've been enjoying the story, you've been enjoying our analysis of what has come through. This is important because the story is not over, and as so many people have said about so many things, it's going to get worse before it gets better, and nowhere is that more apparent than in the next three chapters that we are going to cover today, specifically chapters 10 through 12. Initially, when I first imagined this, I was going to be doing this in a series of four chapters per. And as we went on and started rereading and reviewing and seeing certain chosen stopping places for, like, when Alex created this, as well as several other of his larger books, he would often divide segments of the story into part one, part two, and part three in order to give, like, clear delineating lines for certain, like, not specifically with acts necessarily, but, like, individual arcs for parts of the story. I feel foolish here reviewing my own words, trying to suggest that Let Them Go's structure is not necessarily divided into acts, when that's exactly what it is, a three-act structure. That's why this is a fan podcast, not a school of anything. Toby and I are discussing the things we know about, and often that's just instinctive, unscholarly responses to things. But I decided to leave this bit in unchanged, because if anything, it shows how we tighten up our game later on. More prep, more research, more pre-scribed discussion. And if we ramble or occasionally stumble over our words, so be it. Any editing I do is clarification or cutting the excess cruft off of our dialogue, rather than masking the truth. After all, if we aren't honest about our own experience with the art we love, what's the point in a podcast?
They really do feel like sections, I think, where, and it's one of those odd things where I think that part two is probably the longest in terms of the number of chapters. Yeah. But when you sort of take each part and think about what they kind of embody, I think they all have equal weight behind them.
One of the things we talked about last time was specifically the names that are given to every chapter, but he also gives a name to every part of the story that is meant to be symbolic or indicative of what we are about to read. And in this particular case, part one and part two are very just sort of like matter of fact, where part one is setting up, this is the location that we're in, and part two is be like, okay, this section of the story is all about the Barghest, the monster that's outside, and how that affects our heroes and heroines. And as we approach part three, as I said, I was originally going to do chapters 10 through 13, but chapter 13 and chapter 14, if you have not already read them, are a bit of a flashback, and I felt like dividing the two of those up would not necessarily work as well, especially in terms of, like, we want to discuss what is revealed in the two flashback chapters as a whole. Something people may not be aware of, when this was originally put out to the fans on Patreon, well, first of all, the entire book was originally written, but it was also set up so that when they did the audio drama recordings of this, each individual chapter, while not necessarily ending on a cliffhanger, although some of them very much do, such as the end of chapter 9, there is always some sort of weighty moment to whatever it is that's being talked about. Here is another moment of clarification. When I'm talking about weighty moments, I'm not talking about the growing intensity of action, or even just the natural stopping point of chapters. Audio drama chapters were, and still are, being released a week at a time, and Alex would add some music at the end that was thematic to whatever just happened to add to the overall texture. Like the outro music that often plays after the end of an episode of your favorite TV show. That's what I was responding to when I talked about weight. That said, the music outro for the audio drama isn't new either. It's there from Alex's original beginning with Cartographer's Handbook. When I began this thought during my discussion with Toby, the reason I singled out Let Them Go was actually because it was the first New Century book to be written whole before the audio drama was recorded. As you may recall, the end of Chapter 4 was specifically the end of the reading of the will and all of the emotions that came with that. And the end of chapter 12, which we're going to be discussing coming up, there is very significantly a things on some level have gotten as dark as they possibly can get, emotionally at least. And that's part of the reason why it's a natural lead-on to a flashback, which is, you know, again, this is Alex using his nonlinear storytelling in order to broaden the depth of whatever is going on. Because the story, while the Barghest, while the monster is very much the antagonist of the story, as it is the thing which the heroes are pushing back against, that is causing the action and the despair to be going on, it is not the whole of the story, which is very much focused on Rebecca, and encapsulates everything that has come before, as well as everything that is happening now. But let's continue on with the summary of these chapters and what happens.
Yeah, so, I call this section of the book Managing Dawson.
Well, that is definitely one of the topics that we're going to get into, especially since being that Rebecca and Dawson are, in theory, the only people that are left to work against the tide of the monsters outside. It is very much all about how these two people get on or don't. But the actual
events.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the actual summary. First of all, given the events of the previous chapter where Aunt Chloe went out and dramatically attempted to dispatch the one Wendigo, well, the one Barg. I keep saying that. I keep saying Wendigo. But the term that the story uses is Barghest. It's complicated.
At some point,
I'm just going to start calling them goblins, because that's what they were called by some people in a later book.
Here's what we'll do. Since you're the American half of that, dear, you can call them the Wendigos, and I'll call them the Barghest. I can't even pronounce my own.
I think at one point you were worried about mispronouncing, I think it was somebody else's name or some other word or something like that, and I think you were doing it just fine. I can't remember, so... Getting off topic. After Cleo throws the shotgun to Rebecca as her last dying act, the immediate thing that happens is Dawson fighting with Rebecca over this empty shotgun, not necessarily because it feels like it's going to be of any immediate use, but simply because Dawson's own fear and, shall we say, privilege is getting in the way, and immediately assuming, look, you're a crazy woman and I'm a man, this clearly belongs to me. I mean, the title of this chapter, A Man's Work, is on some level trying to set up, you crazy women have made things worse, it's clearly time for the remaining men to step up and make everything better.
Cue Arrested Development's narrator, they didn't.
The fight between Rebecca and Dawson is very much one of both of them trying to manage their emotions and failing or succeeding on various levels. And why sometimes succeeding on a logical level is actually the worst thing, and succeeding or failing on an emotional level is still the best thing. And nothing is more apparent of this than how episode 10 starts to play out, because Rebecca is attempting to protect herself and her sister, as well as, in theory, is trying to protect all of them from the bull in a china shop activities of Dawson, who is still trying to maintain control of something that he has absolutely no control over.
And he very much is, like, pointedly not evaluating the situation correctly. But once the tussle over the shotgun is complete, with Dawson pulling a really dirty move by just sort of using the butt of the shotgun to, like, hit Rebecca in the ribs. Yeah. So it kind of just shows you that even with his physical strength, he has to kind of resort to dirty tactics. But anyway, the first thing he really talks about is they, meaning the Barghest, will move on by morning, or alternatively, that they're planning to break in and burgle the house. That's what his evaluation is. Manifestly, that is absolutely not what these entities are about. So he wants to have the gun just so he can feel safer, but it's very much like in Lord of the Flies, where there is the token of leadership and the shotgun becomes that.
But
for Rebecca, I think the shotgun, I'm not sure she ever really refers to it as such, but I mentioned in my write-up for this chapter back when it first released that I feel like the shotgun gets added significance because it is the last act that Cleo did was passing the shotgun to Rebecca specifically. So Dawson taking it from her is literally a gut punch. So when you see him using this token of what should be something that is for the best for all of them and misusing it and misappropriating it, it just twists the situation.
I hadn't necessarily thought about it from this perspective because Alex very much has his own writing style, and while he has definite influences of various creators, directors, and such like, one of the things that I was watching, and I encourage you to watch as well in preparation for this story, was very specifically the Guillermo del Toro film Crimson Peak. And one of the things they love to talk about in terms of Guillermo del Toro's stories is what prop, what item is the totem of the various characters in the various movies. One of the things they talked about in Crimson Peak were what prop satisfies that for our three main characters. And having read your discussion on the passing of the shotgun from Cleo to Rebecca and then having it wrested away by Dawson, I don't necessarily know that the shotgun was meant to have any totemic weight to it. But I also agree with you on some level that it isn't not significant, because it is more than a weapon.
When the rifle is first introduced, Rebecca has memories specifically associating it with Uncle Matthew. The rifle quickly adds further symbolic weight when Rafe dies using it to protect them, and then Cleo does the same not long after. If a weapon could be said at all to be haunted, this weapon could easily qualify. Haunted by memory, if not by spirits. Meanwhile, Dawson, a violent outsider and threat to her physical and financial security, is trying to lay claim to it.
It's all important. It all means something. Mm. So
it perhaps doesn't embody any single character in the same way that the totems in the Guillermo del Toro films often do, but I can see your point on that.
We've gotten slightly off topic there. The thing that I wanted
No.
It's all content. It's just we get to it in unusual orders sometimes.
Much like the books sometimes.
Yes, exactly. So as the two of them are like trying to get a handle on what's going on, or in this case, Dawson completely failing to get a handle on what's going on, and Rebecca trying to talk him down from his ideas and opinions that she feels are going to get them killed. Supposedly, a man is supposed to use reason and logic in order to prove their superiority in general over the more emotional woman.
An unfounded and frankly preposterous assertion that people are still trying to use today, reminding us that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
And so she's trying to appeal to him in such a way that will bring him back from the brink. But the problem is that in her analysis of the situation and trying to describe what's going on, much as Amanda was trying to describe it herself when they were alone together in the room, she does too good a job. And it leads them to the situation where Dawson is willing to go up and trying to kill Amanda just to ensure, I would say, their safety, but really it's all about his safety. He really only cares about Rebecca in a very secondary circumstance. It's really all about him, because when he talks about getting a carriage later on and sending a doctor back for them, that's like, I'm getting out of here first, and I'll send you along help if I feel like it. The most important thing here is me.
I think that with Rebecca, every time that she engages in conversation with him, she's talking with him to kind of try and reach a destination that they all find favorable, in much the same way that she kind of was trying to barter with the shop owner next door. We see her kind of practicing these talents. And I think Dawson is someone who always talks at people. You know, he is sort of literally there to read a will at a room. And before they even come to Ravenwood, they all try to talk with him to say, wouldn't it be more sensible if we do this? They're trying to strike up a conversation to talk with him, but he is saying, no, that can't be happened, and I'm the one telling you it. And that may just be the way of his profession, but it's far more likely that this is a reflection of his personality.
Indeed, but that's actually a really good catch, that Rebecca is continuing to use
an argument favoring the good of the whole, which is one she has practice with. But in this case, it backfires because she can't control how Dawson interprets it.
And the thing that I find significant here is logic not necessarily working, but giving into your emotions not necessarily being bad either.
Because when Dawson responds from a place of fear, all the rational arguments Rebecca uses come to no avail. The thing that wins the day is more emotional pronouncement than logic.
This isn't the Dark Ages. They're not throwing leeches on people. We are in an age of science and reason and rationality. We can invent, formulate, and discover our way out of any crisis.
It's too much risk. She could take a turn, come downstairs, and gut us while we wait for the coach.
He barged past and thundered up the stairs. Rebecca hurtled up after him, tripping on the hem of her dress along the way and ripping it apart in her frantic movement.
No! She's locked in. Cleo had the key. She can't get out of there at all.
Dawson was just discovering this as he tried the handle of the master bedroom door. Enraged at its refusal to open, he aimed the muzzle of the shotgun at the lock. Rebecca sprinted the distance between them and grabbed the gun's barrel, shoving it to one side as she clawed at him, whipping the bandage off in her fury and exposing the bite underneath. Dawson reeled in shock as she bellowed into his face.
Kill her. You may as well put this gun in your own mouth, you spineless bastard. Now get away from my sister.
I didn't necessarily know what that meant at first, and it took me a little bit of turning it over in my head. But the thing that the story itself makes clear through visual cues, but also through later Rebecca being in her own head and weighing in the situation, at the moment, the only things that we know is that it is very likely that Amanda has been infected by something. And it is very likely that Dawson has also been infected by that something, because mm-hmm. the book has gone out of its way to say, look, these people were wounded. Now the wound doesn't seem as bad. And mm-hmm. it highlights both of those circumstances. And the point of that last comment that sort of brings Dawson to his senses is, if you are saying that my sister is beyond hope, then you're basically saying that you are beyond hope, too.
Exactly.
She is trying to appeal to that sense of self-preservation, which is causing him to act the way he does. And I just, that is exceptionally well done, obviously.
Exactly. And what I think is brilliant about how that particular confrontation is written is that Rebecca is saying something which is a horrible truth without actually saying it. She is saying, like, okay, you know what? Like, if you're saying that she is doomed because she's infected, then you're doomed because you're infected. But if she actually literally said that, she has no way of knowing how he would necessarily react to it. This is a sort of desperate moment where if she doesn't do something, then her sister is going to die. So she has to kind of bring out all the stops. And it's what gives him pause. And then the next thing they say is, you think that the doctors can cure her or something to that effect. And she says, they are the world's finest after all. And what she is saying there, or what they are saying without saying, is, do you think that they can cure not only her but me? And she's saying, there's a really good chance. You've got to believe that she can be cured, otherwise you don't believe that you can be cured. And that he is still holding onto that old way of doing things, where you don't say the truth of things, you just keep it all buried under this sealed surface. And so she is appealing to that way of talking about things by not actually coming out and saying it. That's why a lot of times in the narration it refers to the fact that Rebecca can't speak candidly about Dawson, and this is something we'll come back to later as one of our talking points, but she has to choose how much she allocates her information and her inferences, because if she gives too much all at once, he acts irrationally, or he acts with an uncontrollable sense of urgency driven by his own fearful preservation. The last thing I'll say just before I forget is that one extra way that they connect what's going on with Amanda being something that's going on with Dawson is not only that the wound is healing, but there is something that Alex does with the colour, because the defining colour of the Vargas is the orange of their eyes. And in the scene where Amanda bites Dawson, she is said to get the honey straight from the jar. And so her mouth is, I think it mentions that the blood of her bite from Dawson and the honey are kind of mixing together. And something about that, to me, the combination of the sort of golden yellowish honey and the red of the blood does show that the components are there to form the orange of the Bargast. And then later, when Dawson is wrestling the shotgun from Rebecca, and these are both moments of these two individuals not quite being fully transformed into these monsters, but showing the vicious tendencies of these monsters.
Sure.
But at this point, Dawson his bandage comes loose, and some of the blood and some of the sort of, apologies for the graphicness of this, but the sort of pus or the yellowish liquid of that wound are said to trickle down his face. And again, that to me kind of sounds like it's the component parts that make up orange. That might be reading too much into it, but A, that's our job, and B, I am fairly certain that a lot of this is maybe little things that Alex is intentionally putting in there, especially with how much they discuss color theory in.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Long-term fans of School of Movies, as well as anyone that has listened to some of the previous roundtables Alex has had with his coterie of voice actors, know about his love of color theory, and how deep that rabbit hole can go, especially with connections to geek lore. Assuming a deeper meaning will likely never go amiss.
There is a specific piece of artwork done for Amanda Wolverton in which
she's in the bed.
When she's in the bed and we can see her wound and we can see her dress is kind of rumpled and she has this sort of strange, unreadable look on her face. But one of the things I noticed on looking back at this, which I had not before, is that her eyes are starting to turn yellow here. And this is actually meant to be a moment not long before she bites Dawson. There is the indication there in the posture and in the eyes and then the look on her face that is meant to hint at the slow transformation that's going on there.
For those of you that read the books, the art is already embedded, but larger versions can be found on newcenturymultiverse.com for this and all of his other works. And it's important to highlight the art because it adds a missing component to the stories that is part and parcel with Alex and Sharon's preferred media, movies.
Which allow for full imagery and movement and use of camera in order to tell the story with every potential sensory component included, with the words and the sounds and the visuals as well. So he will include that however he can, whether it's describing it as best he can in the text or trying to include various artwork to help build the overall experience of the book. The artist, Antonio Torres, hats off to all the things he's contributed to make New Century better. It's a work of art.
Absolutely, quite literally. I think that I hadn't really considered that as paratext that builds on and informs on it. I think it is second to none as to how it really does make a lot of New Century feel that much more complete, because as you say, film is Alex's favorite medium, and I think there was a conversation on Twitter earlier today where Alex did talk about how a lot of his writing is kind of picked up on and informed by his experience analyzing films, and so a lot of his writing, I think, is written as if you could see the shots in your mind, as if this was a film coming together. And I think that he mentions how Let Them Go was originally meant to be almost like a screenplay for a short film that he would have in his mind. But I think that of all the stories, and I think he said this as well, that Let Them Go would be probably lend itself the best to being made into a film, because it just has so much of its writing just captures these things. And one of my favorite moments, I forget if it's in this chapter specifically, but it's when Rebecca looks through the keyhole and Manda is there but looking back at her, but she's not fully illuminated. That always stood out in my mind, and I can see exactly how that would look, and it's terrifying, it's eerie. I think Alex mentioned that he feels some regret that he doesn't have more time to read, or he struggles to read other books from his contemporaries who are doing similar things to him. And I think that even with those doubts, Let Them Go would work fantastically as a film, but it works exceptionally well as written word. And I know we've emphasized the audio elements of this a lot, but the words are very carefully selected, and it builds up this beautiful picture.
One of Alex's longtime $15 sponsors on Patreon mentioned briefly, I don't remember if it was Let Them Go specifically, but he had been working through the entire back catalog. He hadn't actually read any of New Century yet, but he mentioned just about how well the words brought him into the story and were able to coax an emotional reaction out of him. And Alex thanked him for his words, but also just like it made him feel better overall that to someone who was not necessarily able to listen to the audio drama, which includes all this extra detail and content, that the words alone could be as impactful as they were. So it speaks very much to his ability to draw that out.
The patron in question is Nick Ord, and in the months since this was originally recorded, he has read almost all of New Century, and is in the process of going back and listening to the audio drama for each. Encouraged by Alex, he has started his own blog called Midnight Movies Online, where he has started analyzing horror movies that he finds compelling, and I was impressed enough by not only his writing but his sudden love for New Century that me and Toby invited him on to talk about Let Them Go as it fits into the horror genre overall. This fun extra will be released in a month, alongside the episode of our final analysis of Let Them Go.
Me personally, and this is skipping far, far ahead, but
I mentioned back in our introductory episode that the origin of this podcast came from my own emotional response to Uncivil Outlaw. It had been released January 5th of this year, and I read it in a day. I couldn't possibly wait for the audio drama after the way Phase 1 had eaten up my brain, and I never had a doubt the novel alone would be compelling. And I was right. The novel emotionally wrecked me, and I mean that in the best possible way.
I mean, you've read it, you know how it gets in certain places. No spoilers, mm-hmm. but nope. It... I literally reached out to you. Weeks later, I'm still thinking and feeling about this. I wanted to talk about it with someone that I knew cared as much about these books as I did, and that's when you said, hey, let's do a podcast. And so, voila, there we are. The power of Alex's writing has led to, I hope, another great creation for people to enjoy.
Oh, that's what happens, is that creativity sparks more creativity.
Listeners, if you are inspired by our discussion and want to contribute, there are a couple different ways we can integrate that. Obviously, there is a dedicated forum on the School of Movies Discord server to discussing New Century in general. And like with Nick, taking the time to come on and have an in-depth conversation with Toby and myself is always on the table. But if you just have some ideas, big or small, you'd like to share, reach out to us on Twitter or Discord. While we have several recorded episodes just waiting to be edited for release, I am more than happy to add a specific section at the end of future episodes where I read out your comments, questions, and other fan responses to New Century or Through the Wind Door.
This is not just meant to be the two of us talking about a subject. Ideally, we are doing this in order to rally and engage the fan base by bringing to them ideas and thoughts and reigniting their love of something that they enjoy. And
absolutely.
That's the overall goal. Otherwise, you know, we could be having, Toby and I could be having Skype sessions where we're just talking about this all ourselves and none of y'all would ever hear it. And that, you know, that sates us perhaps, but we would hope to create something bigger than that. Just like Alex is trying to create something bigger himself based on other people's love of listening to him and Sharon talk about other people's work. You know, this is just continuing the cycle.
Yeah, and thank God you're here, audience, because if not, then Greg and I would just never stop, honestly.
Yeah.
So, like, these episodes do have to come to an end, and we will meet up next time, but otherwise it would just be the timer would go on and on and on.
All right, so we haven't even finished the summary at this point, but that's fine, because part of our conversation has been discussing some of the topics that I wanted to bring up for these chapters. But before we head on to the next chapter, one of the things that you mentioned when we were discussing the whole how Rebecca chooses to frame that one line, if you kill her, you may as well put the gun in your own mouth, in order to try and bring Dawson back from his erratic behavior. So something that women are constantly attempting to do in the case of men, and certainly applies beyond the gender spectrum and gender politics and everything like that, is that very often the way to convince someone bullheaded of something, or someone that doesn't necessarily respect anybody's opinions but his own, is to make someone else think that whatever plan of action is going on or whatever conclusion, make them think it was their own idea. And it feels like Rebecca's choice of words may be partially reflective of that, that by framing it the way that she does, she's not giving him the answer. She's just leading him right up to the answer that he can then ostensibly come to his own conclusion and realize that, oh yes, no, this actually makes perfect sense, and I'm the one that came up with it because I'm the only one that has opinions that matters.
Good job, me.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, obviously from a certain standpoint, this is a very dramatic moment, and Rebecca may not necessarily have been able to think that concretely, but given her understanding of the way society works and the fact that she is constantly put in these positions where she has to manage the feelings of men around her in order to get them to do what she wants, or just in order to retain her own agency, she is sort of used to thinking in that mindset. So it wouldn't surprise me at all that even in this heated moment, her words and her thinking leads her back into certain patterns which have served her well into this past. This very may well have been deliberate. Anyway, so we've unpacked a lot just in that one chapter. But as we continue on, Dawson has at the very least been talked down from doing anything hugely dramatic in terms of Amanda. As Rebecca returns down the stairs to Dawson attempting to do anything in order to feel like he's in better control of the situation, it allows us to get a sense of more of the house that has such symbolic significance to him. Rebecca, as Dawson is like, oh, just get me more nails. We need to protect ourselves. And it's an opportunity for Rebecca to find more potential tools to deal with the situation. But it also allows us to delve more into her feelings about the house and the house itself.
The reason why this is significant is not simply narrative, where Alex is setting the stage for Act 3 of the story. It's also important because Rebecca needs to prepare herself mentally for what is to come. That doesn't just include her emotional state, but also understanding whatever resources she has available, whether those are items, insights, or knowledge. Knowledge in particular of the house itself.
As Rebecca returns with the thing that Dawson asked for, she points out, hey, this isn't necessarily going to work out. We need to come up with an alternate strategy here. Let me slowly, so that you can understand in order to quell your own rage, be like, okay, let's do this and then do this. And as that's going on, she continues to attempt to engage Dawson in conversation, which isn't, you can only normalize this situation so well. But if there's anything that would be distracting, or, you know, allow Dawson to feel more secure, that's essentially what's going on here. Part of the following two chapters are Rebecca and Dawson interacting, but we also see a whole lot more inside Rebecca's head as she tries to figure out what is going to get her through the next few moments, what is going to get her through the night, what is going to allow her to protect herself and to protect Amanda, and her trying to make sense of everything that is going on and seeing Dawson starting to act erratic, just as I alluded to a moment ago, that he's infected with something. How long do I have before this change starts taking effect? We don't actually know how much time has passed. It feels like not much time at all has passed. The important events of the story just seem to have come bam, 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 one right after the other.
It's a continuous flow of events.
Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why we don't necessarily know how much time has passed, there are time skips, particularly as we get into Chapter 12, where the two of them indulge in a long, drawn-out conversation, only part of which we're privy to. But because Alex is inspecific about the time frame, it makes everything feel far more present, which helps the story to ratchet up tension on a dime, but also gives a place to de-escalate that same tension when needed. Because if we go too long at full tilt, it reduces or even ruins the ability for the narrative to keep us engaged. I'm not a media buff like Alex and Sharon, but I've heard them and others talk a lot about the importance of using emotional highs and lows properly in films, and especially where action and horror are concerned. It isn't until later stories where we find out, hey, this is exactly how much time is needed for a human to become monster. And this story doesn't allow us to figure out what that time frame is at all. It feels like it all happens so quickly.
That's a very good point, sorry, because a lot of the chapters in other New Century books are kind of written with a sort of almost like a diary entries or reports where you really do get a sense of when and where we are and almost who we are because we're seeing different perspectives. But the whole point with this is because the narration is from a sort of third-person narrator, and in the audio version, the narration is read by Alex, who I believe doesn't actually voice a character in this story. But if you're new to this, then it's just the strength of the writing in and of itself. But if you are returning to Let Them Go after, at the time, it was not the first New Century book that had come out, so there were people who were familiar with this world, and even if you are conscious of what the Barghest is and how long it takes for them to the infection to take hold, because it's presented in this different way, it does kind of take away all your sense of safety and security. So that's a very good point of yours, Greg.
Yeah. That is definitely something that's going to be brought up in the future in terms of Alex will constantly shake up how he is presenting the story. Some of the stories are from the perspective of an omniscient narrator saying, these are the sequence of events in the case of the cartographer's handbook. Many of the others take the place of journal entries in the case of somebody else is going to be reading these later, or sometimes it shifts back into this is what's happening right now because there is recordings of people talking. And the idea of playing with time is also a very significant thing that comes up again and again in various books, where the ones involving people are often be like, okay, this is the time of day, this is what day it is, this is how much time has passed, this is the hour, this is the moment. I was listening to the edit, and the patter of my voice along with the words that I used made me think of something very deep in my childhood, and I just had to splice it in, so apologies. Getting back to how one frames time in storytelling, Alex takes us from the immediacy of Let Them Go to the rigidly structured delineation of secret rooms, and then to the far more nebulous Tiger's Eye, which completely disconnects you from the normal flow of time because we're dealing with people who look at time very differently.
We'll say about that for now.
Yeah, exactly. Getting back to the story. So yeah, there's a lot of internal dialogue at this point. everything that Rebecca is doing is meant to ideally protect from the bar guest, but it serves as an additional point in attempting to protect herself from Dawson. He is not an ally. He is another threat that has to be managed. And that's where I wanted to bring up this topic in our list, which is that I'm not necessarily drawing on personal experience from this. I know that it's something that comes up more than once in Alex's writings. As someone that has had multiple experiences of their own, trying to manage the emotions of others in order to protect myself emotionally, if not physically, Rebecca is responding to Dawson as someone that is not necessarily that she is in an abusive relationship with him, because obviously she isn't, even though he is abusive in his selfishness and his inability to control himself. But people that go out of their way to be people-pleasing or to apologize profusely for things, certain kinds of behaviors are generally indicative of someone has experienced and had to deal with abuse in their past, and therefore has learned how to integrate certain kinds of coping mechanisms or behaviors in order to try and mitigate this. It makes me wonder a little bit about the stuff that we never really find out about in terms of the day-to-day ongoing relationship between Rebecca and her father. There is some hint at the possibility that there wasn't actually that much of a period in between the death of Timothy and then the year in which they returned to Ravenwood, where Charles completely lost his shit and threw a plate at Uncle Matthew. The implication there is that not long after that, he went off to attend to business for the good of the family, and therefore there wasn't necessarily a huge amount of time in between for Charles to behave very badly towards either of his daughters in response to what happened with Timothy. But from another standpoint, and I can't really speak accurately to any of this, because not having lived in that time, not being a woman during that time, I feel like maybe on some level, it's just one of those things that all women had to deal with. Their safety, their security, their own privilege was so dependent on other men that there may have been some sort of stuff going on in which all women had to be placating of most men in order to avoid violence and conflict and all the like. How do you feel about that mouthful that I just laid on you?
No, I think that you're sadly very right, that it is something where, even though what we know of Rebecca up to this point, and speaking candidly, what we know about her from just us having read further along but not wanting to spoil anything, I don't think that Rebecca has ever been in a romantic relationship which ended up being an abusive relationship. But I think that it is certainly very specifically with her interactions with her father after the death of Timothy, and the father very clearly resented and to some extent blamed her for Timothy's death. I think that that is all likelihood an emotionally abusive relationship, even and we don't know anything else of what other abuse there may have been, but whatever the interaction was, it was definitely a very negative relationship that came at a very formative moment of Rebecca's life. So on a personal level, yes, she would, I think, have, like, be wary of the dispositions of men who have, whether or not they deserve the authority, they have nevertheless taken it up or seized it. And in this situation, Dawson seems to be doing that. So she maybe has some ingrained ability to placate the disposition of these unfit men. But in a harrowing way, on a larger scale, I think that you are absolutely right, that certainly in this time period, and extending beyond it, it would be something that a lot of women, if not all women at this point in history, would have worked out a way to tiptoe around the men whose way of life was determined by these men. And it's harrowing stuff, and I, and that's putting it lightly, so I do apologize if I'm doing a disservice to this weighty subject matter. The title of Chapter 10, A Man's Work, to kind of summarize everything we're talking about, I can think of nothing better than to say that of all the titles of all the different chapters, and there's some frightening ones coming up, I think A Man's Work is the title that unsettles me the most.
That's actually a really good call right there, because it's not just... It makes me think of the horribly evocative term that is associated with bad race relations in America, white man's burden, which is meant to be something significant to men of privilege at the time, but is actually a horribly racist, has horribly racist connotations, because I'm not sure that I'm completely prepared to unpack, but this story doesn't even get into racial relations. We'll get into that in later stories and everything like that, but that's the emotional core of
Can't wait.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Now that's on some level, we're going to have to emotionally prepare ourselves for getting into some of the stuff in later books. Well, that quote aged horribly in current context. Like you're saying, A Man's Work feels like a very unsettling title. That's because there is emotional weight behind what we associate with those words, and the fact that we also associate it with men that even you and I wouldn't feel comfortable around. The things that we've been talking about so far, I would feel more comfortable talking about them with Sharon present, or really even any other woman present that could speak better to their own personal experience, even in the modern world, about what it means to have to deal with the privilege and the egos of men. We're two men trying to talk about this, and while I feel we're generally decent people that do our best to, you know, deal with our own flaws, but also try and see past all of the male bullshit. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't change the fact that we will only experience a small part, or be able to understand a small part
of what women have had to live with then and now.
But one of the things I did want to bring up is that something I'm seeing more and more often now, especially through social media, you know, on some level it doesn't matter if Charles was ever physically abusive to Rebecca, or if any other man was physically abusive to Rebecca. We should not and must not discount the power of emotional abuse, and how that should not be tolerated any more than hitting someone should. Like, well, great, you're someone that doesn't hit women, great, but if you're doing other things in order to abuse or gaslight or just generally screw with the emotions of others, you're still a bad person. Yeah, exactly. You're a bad person, and fuck you. Yeah. See, it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that we're not talking about race relations or anything else like that. We'll find a way to exhaust ourselves just talking about the stuff that we've got here.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
But there is light, everyone. I promise you that although we are engaging with this heavy stuff here, and as we've referred to, there is other heavy stuff that we're going into as we dive further into this series. What is important is that there is always light to these books, and hope. That is something we will always celebrate with these stories, and try to let that sort of message of light and hope kind of ripple out with us discussing it.
That has always been Alex's remit, and one of the things that it's been interesting to listen to him talk about is his ongoing frustration with stories that delve too much into the darkness of whatever is going on without that eventually heroic ending, or without even the hope that things could eventually be better. I'm sorry, what was that? No.
Just, yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah. No, it's perfectly okay. In the conversation Toby and I had prior to the podcast, he invoked Samwise Gamgee's words towards the end of The Two Towers, that there's some good in the world and worth fighting for. That isn't just Alex's thesis statement. It's something to hold on to hard right now. Now, during the violence and chaos of the moment, and also as we talk about a lot of difficult things on the podcast itself. We spend so much time discussing the darkness of the book because we're analyzing what we feel about what is written. Please also keep in mind that there are good things to talk about as well. Mm-hmm. The dark is covered. We are going to make sure that the light comes through as we discuss these things. Some of that light, on some level, is present in Chapter 12. Well, Chapter 12 already sets off with a momentous... What is Chapter 12? Chapter 12 is breaking points, or only like, oh crap, the shit is about to hit the fan here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still difficult to get through, even though it begins very benignly. Like, on some level, the title of this story is, it's like the reverse of a quiet moment several chapters ago.
Yeah,
where,
it is a bit like a dark parallel to it, isn't it?
Yeah, a quiet moment makes you think that this is going to be, you know, a moment to let us come back from the edge here, and it is right up until the end. And breaking point makes you think, oh shit, things are going to start to go down right now, and it starts with, tell me about your wife. You know, it starts with
I'm sorry, what? Dawson has a wife?
Yes, exactly. The previous chapter was preparations. The conversation which Rebecca leads Dawson into is still more of these preparations, because some of the stuff in the earlier chapter was all about protecting themselves specifically from the threat outside. Now she is doing her best in order to protect herself from the threat inside, which is Dawson, because she doesn't know how much time she has left, and it's going to work out better if she can get him into a place where he feels as unthreatened as possible. And it's at this point that I want to bring up, there is a concept in storytelling, most often in movies, but really it lends itself to any kind of storytelling, which I think was quoted, or it was came up with originally by Robert Ebert of Siskel and Ebert, which is the conservation of characters. And it's usually significant in terms of, if you're dealing with a mystery, then very often a function of good storytelling is that if there's a murder, then whoever did it is a character that has been already introduced at a certain point. Like, they're not going to bring in somebody from the outside, particularly since one of the characteristics of good mysteries is to potentially lay out all the facts and events and details in the movie in such a way that you're able to figure out who did it if you're able to follow the logic that the storytellers or the cinematographers or the directors have laid out for you. In this particular case, there are mysterious elements, and some of those mysteries will actually get finally resolved in the last five chapters in our session next week. But here, the significance is we find out that Dawson actually knows our erstwhile victim from the prologue, William Smythe, because he brings up Smythe as, you know, I was up here visiting him, and that's how I first met my wife. And that ongoing, like, conservation of characters also comes through when Rebecca is in her own head trying to get a handle on everything and finding out that one of the Bargess is actually the maid, Elsie, that had been assisting Aunt Cleo earlier in the story and has suddenly come back into it as a monster, implying that, oh no, her carriage must have been set upon by the original Barghest or by some other Barghests. Like, we don't necessarily know how far the virus has spread at this point. But for the purposes of this story, we have the original guy that escaped from the asylum. We have Elsie, and we have a third man who could be anybody, could have even been the driver of the carriage that Elsie was in. We don't know. But Alex is using all of the characters here as components in the story. It's very much a blink and you'll miss it thing, but I like...
Indeed, I did. You had to point it out to me.
Yeah, exactly. But I very much like the idea, you know, to use all parts of what you've created in order to lend verisimilitude, in order to lend depth to the story that's being told. I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference in the long term, but, you know, at the very least, to be like, oh yeah, that makes a certain degree of sense. And I like it when things come into play, and when you look closely at things or you remember things, you can sort of pat yourself on the back for having, you know, noticed the little Easter egg, even if it was just meant to be a throwaway callback or whatever.
No, I think it works well because I remember when the story was first releasing that when you listen to the prologue, you think, oh, that's a good tone setter. That kind of is a little isolated, like, incident that kind of gives you a little taste of what's to come later, and you kind of forget about it. With that little connection, it does show you that that sequence was more than just a taster, that it actually does have real in-world consequences, and one of those consequences is the main characters are going to have to deal with this extra person who was infected because of this. So I think it's a great little point of connection, and I'm glad that you pointed me towards it.
I can go through books very quickly, and obviously in this particular case where I was listening to the audio drama, it often meant that I was having to pay more attention to it, otherwise I would miss significant things. Reading books, on the other hand, it's easier to go back almost immediately and catch things. I find myself often tuning out every little detail if I am reading a huge block of text, but the advantage there is that I can often just go right back to the start of the paragraph and pay more attention if I notice myself doing that. It takes more effort to do the same with audiobooks, because using the rewind function is not as precise. And since catching all those details was going to be important for the podcast, I used the strengths of both audio and text to do so. It was hard work, not me being exceptionally observant. I can be that, sometimes. So can Toby, so can anyone. In my experience, sometimes individual details or moments capture you, and sometimes what you like about a book is not necessarily the smaller moments, but how you felt emotionally after having read it. That's like, those emotions are often what I'm drawing on when trying to remember movies that I saw a long time ago, like as a child even, that I remember how I felt, and maybe there are individual things or lines or scenes that spike back in the memory. But I've often had to either rewatch these movies with a critical eye, or more often I've had to listen to Alex and Sharon talk about these movies with other people in great detail, listen to them talk about their emotions, or unpack things in a way that I would never have been able to, in order to sort of get at understanding why it was that I felt the way I did. And that's part of the reason why doing this with you, hearing what you have to say about it, and trying to write things down as they come up in my own head, it's kind of important to me because it allows me to understand why this particular part of the story was so difficult to get through, or why it was that after having read Let Them Go, my very first thought was, oh my goodness, this was an amazing story. I want to read more, but part of me never wants to read this particular story again because it's too emotionally hard-hitting.
Luckily, you'll never have to do a podcast on it, so that won't happen.
Well, to be perfectly honest, doing the podcast has sort of allowed me to expel some of these difficult feelings. I would have to say that anything involving gaslighting or emotional abuse is particularly difficult for me because I have to watch other people go through it or watch people be abusive assholes. And on some levels, that is more difficult for me to deal with than super violence of a movie like Upgrade or The Raid or any horror movie which involves a lot of GRU and everything like that. Because it is something that's more familiar, whereas violence in general is far more alien to my personal experience. I haven't experienced a lot of violence. I have experienced a lot of times where I felt unsafe emotionally.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm not trying to make myself out to be some kind of... I was about to use the word snowflake, but bad people...
We don't use that term, no.
No, and I shouldn't denigrate my experience in comparison to people that have gone through more serious things, but, you know, this is what empathy does. I am responding with a great deal of empathy to this particular story, so... Yeah. You know, thank you for doing this podcast with me so that I'm able to, you know, the creative work that is this podcast is almost an exorcism. The story will no longer haunt me the way it had before, and I hope that our work might help others towards that end as well.
Yeah, well, as is definitely what is gone into and explored in this specific story is that engaging with these ghosts and things that haunt you is a necessary thing. And again, I shan't go too much into that. That can be for later,
That is going to be an important moment in the story. But that stuff is for next time. So let's just move right along to our notes for today. So Rebecca is having this conversation with Dawson and learning some things about him. I mean, you know, it's very possible that she has empathy for his situation as well. But to be perfectly honest, when he talks about his experience with his wife, all I can think of is, my goodness, what does this woman have to deal with living with this guy? I mean, maybe it's not nearly so bad because he's a man of some amount of prestige and privilege. And, you know, he is able to keep her comfortably, you know, talking about, you know, taking her on rowing trips, which she ostensibly wanted to do just so he could show off his rowing arms, his great strength or whatever. But it just makes me hope that things never got so stressful for Dawson's wife, that maybe her willingness to cede to his wishes and make sure that he wants for nothing, as he says, is just a natural, like, she is someone that very much loves her husband and merely does this as an expression of that love rather than having to do it because she feels like she's being emotionally abused or the like. We never find out enough of what Dawson is like when he's not feeling scared and threatened.
It's a cocktail of a scene because I think that what seems to be very important to Alex as a writer is that even some of his darker characters have moments of humanity. One of his shorter books, which is nevertheless an important book, The Christmas Thieves, is very much about granting humanity to one of his most, on the surface, irredeemable characters. And
yeah.
I think that this scene does grant a certain amount of humanity to Dawson before he loses it forever. And it's this cocktail because the narration mentions that for the first time, Dawson's expression softens and he's this hard stick in the mud for so much of the book. But at this point, it does show that there is love there and there is something where I think the best of him is probably there. But what complicates it is that there is intermingled with the humanity just enough of those snarling signs of the sort of the relinquishing of his humanity and the willingness to do so are breaking through the surface. And it's something about the words it sends a shiver down my spine when he says she makes everything so easy or something like that. And it's also the particular reading of the lines where it's a speech where it's not all one thing or the other, and that's what makes it hard and complicated. And even when they turn the conversation over to Rebecca, he does actually ask after Rebecca, and even though his sort of words of comfort in heavy quotation marks are particularly Dawson-esque and just kind of make her feel even worse probably, but Rebecca does a good job of not slapping him around the face, but it is nevertheless like, at least he tried.
Yes, there is definitely a balancing act going on here, because Rebecca is very well aware that it's not just that he's potentially a very distasteful person in life, but that he is getting to the point where it almost doesn't matter whether he is redeemable as a person or not, because he is quickly going to become something that is only interested in eating her. She never loses sight of that. But it doesn't change the fact that, like you say, his way of being comforting and, you know, trying to act like everything is normal, his thing to say is, oh, you know what, everyone else in your life is dead, so I guess you get all the money and the houses now. Silver lining, eh? And in the actual audio drama, Sharon's voice playing Rebecca is just so very flat.
I count my lucky stars.
Exceptionally well played there.
The
ongoing significance there is, and this not much of a spoiler because it's literally leading on to it from here, the story that we only hear about in small details, that is going to become very significant in a second, because it's going to be the second moment where we actually have an extended flashback, as was mentioned earlier in the podcast.
It is here that some of those small earlier mysteries will be answered, but the flashback is also going to finally bring some of the other gothic elements that have been perhaps absent right up until now. But I wasn't necessarily expecting that when I first read the book. I was like, oh, that's an interesting detail. You know, I guess it's not really germane to what's going on, so maybe that's the reason why we don't hear about the story. And then after the events in this chapter, it's like, nope, we're going to get right into that. It's all important. You know, that comes back to something we're going to say again and again. As far as New Century is concerned, it's all important.
Yep. There is going to be a wrinkle added to this story imminently, dear listener.
Before we move on, I wanted to add an epiphany I had just today. When Rebecca was talking about her mystery love, I was having an emotional response to the tone and the words she used when talking about him to Dawson. Only as a result of the very recent School of Movies podcast on The Princess Bride did I realize it sounded like Princess Buttercup talking about her memory of Wesley.
But there was one that I loved truly. And next to him, all others were but brightly painted wooden toys, wrought in a similar shape.
He sounds like a splendid fellow indeed, to capture a girl's heart so. Was he wealthy?
No,
Rebecca said, thinking back.
He didn't have much in his pockets, but he had the whole world at his feet.
I didn't have a better place to insert this, so I'll now return you to the original recording. But eventually, Dawson is made irate by the situation again, and it's now that Rebecca basically sees her opportunity. Well, opportunity is as much as, you know, like realizing that she may be running out of time here. So she sets herself up for the situation to be like, you know, since this gun is so important to you, I think there might be a possibility that there are more shells in the basement. Specifically able to point out the giant door in the floor where they might be hiding as they go down there, and Dawson continues to be irate and everything.
Before this, she had to venture outside in a scene which everything has been very tight and intimate in here, and that's kind of where a lot of the discomfort comes from, is the threat inside. And when she ventures out to grab a set of keys from Aunt Cleo's body, it's a really effective moment of the type of fear being examined suddenly being flipped, because suddenly we're going from a fear of claustrophobia to a fear of agoraphobia, I believe it is, where suddenly you're in this huge, wide open space and you're not able to see any of it, and it threatens to swallow Rebecca up. And it happens very quickly, just as it does within the story, but it's a gauntlet that stays with you. And as soon as she's finished with that gauntlet, she moves on to this new one with Dawson.
The juxtaposition of being in a confined space to being in a wide open space, and both of them are very dark. One of the things, again, I think I mentioned this last time, that I did in preparation for this story was rewatching Pitch Black, the movie with Riddick. There's a little bit of that same stuff going on in the movie, wherein there's wide open space and it's completely dark out and you don't know which direction that danger is going to come from. That's what's present every time people venture out into the open and are set upon by bar guests. And so that threat is present now when Rebecca goes out to get keys. And then when she goes back in, the danger is still present. The danger is just, in theory, coming from a different place. And being in a confined area has different dangers associated with it. Either way, she has to use her wits and all of her facilities and use her environment in order to survive what happens next. But in the end, she does in fact manage to grab the shotgun, get out of the basement, and successfully lock Dawson in, even after the whole thing with, like, you know, whenever you're dealing with keys, you have to fiddle with all the keys in order to find the right one.
Yeah, but I love that and hate it, because it takes, I mentioned this in my write-up, but it takes something that is infinitely familiar to anyone who has had to lock up or something, and if you're sort of in a bit of a rush, you're like, okay, this key, no, it's not that key, it's not even the second, oh, why isn't it the third key? And like, imagine that, but there is a werewolf who is coming to kill you. Like, yeah, it's just insane levels of stress. It's, well, like, I mean, I said, yeah, brilliant and awful at the same time.
It's something that comes up again and again. It doesn't matter if it's a werewolf or, you know, a thing with a spike for a head or Jason Voorhees or whatever it is. It's a trope, but it's instead of one of those tropes which has necessarily been overused or whatever, it's one of those with striking familiarity. And, you know, it's just a general, like, it's bad enough when you're dealing with a set of unfamiliar keys, which is what Rebecca is attempting to deal with here. Whenever you're scared or in a stressful situation, it's that much harder, especially when you're dealing with something as flimsy and flippant as keys. I feel like to a certain extent that might be part of the reason why later on car keys are so now much more significant than any other key that you might have on your ring. Like, it tends to have like a fob attached to it that has, like, you know, remote control allowing you to unlock or lock or whatever. Those all have their places. But even before that, the key that you use in order to open the door or start the car tends to be larger and more significant than your standard house key. And maybe that's, I don't know if that, I don't think it was designed intentionally that way for the purposes of getting away from killers. At the very least, when she is specifically looking for the key for the basement, she is looking for a key that stands out from all the others, hoping that it is, because it's the basement key, it does stand out more, and as it turns out, it in fact does. So, yes, she manages to lock the monster in the basement, because at this point, Dawson is more or less a monster. He does seem to eventually stop battering the door, for now at least, perhaps brought there by Rebecca's words, like maybe there is something enough left of Dawson that she is once again able to get through to him using her logic or her emotional appeal or whatever. Whatever does it, The point is that for the moment at least, she's safe. But having said that, her success isn't a Pyrrhic success, but it is a success to be like, okay, I've saved myself for the moment, but I have nothing and nobody left. Where the heck do I go from here? How am I going to survive what comes next? Which then, therefore, makes the next two chapters very necessary. As you wrote in your blog, Rebecca is now at her lowest point. She's trying to reach out to Amanda for some glimmer of hope, but Amanda is either not there or is fully transformed or is just thoroughly under the sway of both the infection and the super dose of laudanum she's taken. So Rebecca retreats inside her mind and therefore gets us a glimpse of a world prior to all of this tragedy coming to be and gives us a far richer story in the end. Unfortunately, we are going to have to get back to that next time on Through the Wind Door. But before we continue on, are there any last thoughts that you wanted to bring up regarding the story or regarding these chapters?
Just going to check over my notes quickly. Up to this point, we've been... I forget if they are included in the final audiobook or novel of Let Them Go, but in the original podcast episodes as they were coming out, there would be these little epilogues and postscript sort of notes about things that sort of flesh out the world, and they were often very sort of Gravity Falls-esque in that they would be these little mysterious things where sometimes you understood exactly what they were referring to and other times they kind of make you ask what is going on. And in these three episodes, I think we have a mention of when Rebecca is telling Dawson that about the story of, oh, I once knew a man who passed through a pane of glass and it tore him to shreds. To shreds, you say? But,
oh, great. Now we're totally turning into school movies.
I
one of your favorite memes.
That was a regular quote long beforehand. It was just intensified when my favorite podcast started quoting it as well. But the epilogue reveals to us that she was lying. She didn't know anyone who did... I don't know if the fact that, because Alex, the narrator, simply says Rebecca was lying about the pane of glass. Now, that may just mean that she never knew anyone. The whole story was a fabrication. And I mean, she tells the story, even though it's rather morbid, as a way to comfort Dawson, because the whole point is that the windows are their minimal bit of defense, that he isn't able to board up the windows and they've left the teacups as a sort of alarm, and that they would, no matter what, they'd have to jump through the window glass. And it's something where her saying that, she's sort of saying it almost conversationally as if she was, it's like, oh, this is a horrible story, but she's deliberately mentioning it as a comfort that we don't have just nothing up in defense. There is something. But it could be that, or she really did know someone who went through the pane of glass and they weren't torn to shreds. A lot of these epilogues are kind of left ambiguous. And the one which I'm very intrigued by, because it's just a lot of these little mysteries, which perhaps they'll remain unanswered, or perhaps they have yet to be answered, but... In, I think, the last episode, chapter 12, it mentions that at this very spot, i.e. where Rebecca ends the episode, which I think is either it's like literally where she is in the house or it's just the spot of Ravenwood, it says a long time ago, a promise was made at the witching hour. And that sort of stuck out to me, and I thought... wonder what that promise was and who it was made to, and just these little things. And anyone who's listened to the Q&A that Greg and I did with Alex knows that I was always very intrigued in these, and I think it's for the best that they elements are being brought into the story proper so that everyone gets to enjoy them. But if I sort of notice any of these in the re-listen or the revisiting of these stories, I will make sure I bring them up and we can speculate wildly about them.
Well, it's certainly going to be extra content. I do miss that. What Toby is referring to is that when Alex was putting out individual audio drama chapters for the Patreon feed, that after the credits, something he was doing was putting out a little stinger, which in this case were, as you say, small little snippets of stories. You could not listen to them, and you would still have the whole story of Let Them Go or whatever it was that he was doing it for. I think it was Steamheart was the other big one you mentioned. But unfortunately, there is the overall tendency of people to not listen to the end of credits or not even listen to the credits at all. So a lot of cases, these little snippets went unheard, and Alex eventually decided to stop doing them because it was just extra work for him. I do like the idea that some of these moments found new life inside the story proper.
Something that came up during the Steamheart Q&A was that I hadn't at first noticed the more prominent stingers at the end of the audio dramas themselves. The Marvel Cinematic Universe movies was my first exposure to the idea, and while I was more familiar with its presence in short-form YouTube videos, such as the ones put out by Loading Ready Run or Linkara, I wasn't expecting to find it in an audio drama. It was only while reading a TV Tropes page dedicated to the New Century audio dramas that I realized what I was missing. The concept does exist more familiarly in novels as an epilogue, and had I read the books instead, I would have seen these more readily. But Alex was trying to invoke a specific well-loved TV series with his addition of a stinger to every chapter released on the New Century feed, so I'm sorry that it didn't find success there.
Well, this was a heavy episode, probably the heaviest one that we've done so far, but we hope we've entertained you, and look forward to you in the next one, seeing you around the multiverse.
Around the multiverse.